The following Stealing the Mind Bible Conference presentation is by Chuck Missler and is entitled Earth, Energy, and Economics. For a free catalog of over 200 awesome Stealing the Mind Bible studies on DVDs, CD, or audio tape, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 or on the web at compass.org.
Thank you. Bill asked me to talk about the Earth, energy, economics, and other crises. And so he didn't want me to use this as the last talk because you wouldn't sleep very well overnight. So you'll have a lunch hour to digest what we're going to talk about here a little bit. But let's talk about the State of the Union of our country, 2008. First question is, where is the most dangerous place for an American to be today? In the womb of the mother. He has one chance in four of being murdered. That's kind of exciting. We have a legacy of despair. 48 million legal abortions since Roe versus Wade. That's 1.6 million per year. 4,000 per day. Almost 200 per hour that we're murdering. 3 abortions per minute. Every 20 seconds, an unborn child is murdered in the womb of its mother. You know, the ancient cultures would put him on Moloch and so forth. We found a more insulting way, the most sacred place of all, to murder a child. When did John the Baptist begin his ministry? When he was 9 inches long, weighed 1.5 pounds, he jumped for joy and the Spirit filled. That should end it. That should end the argument. Okay. Yes, we are in free-falling America. You've heard me go through the litany of indictments here. We're in cultural free-fall. I see Californians have legalized homosexual marriage. And we could go on and on. We have support from the mainline media, from the entertainment industry, from our educational establishment, our political institutions, and even some of our religious denominations support this concept. In fact, there is a dominant political party is committed to attacking all those things that were our heritage, the family and family values and so on and so forth. They shouldn't be called liberals. That's a misnomer. You know, the homosexuals have solved their vocabulary problem. They adopted the term gay and the media bought it. Nothing gay about that lifestyle. It's life-shortening. We call them liberals. They're not liberal. They're not tolerant unless you agree with them. They have an agenda to separate you from your heritage. That's called subversive. Let's call it by what it is. But that's put us in a moral freefall. Free drugs, promiscuity, sexual transmitted diseases among our teenagers. And on it goes. And they're committed to outlawing free speech, the so-called fairness doctrine, which is an attempt to squelch conservative radio and religious radio, their tax against homeschooling, and so forth. And that, of course, all that has led to financial freefall, which we're all beginning to face. Every one of us are getting pinched pretty tight, right? And it's not just about the gas in your tank, by the way. We'll get to that. We have $110 trillion debt that's beginning to collapse around our ears. There's a terminal destruction of the U.S. dollar. Morgan Stanley said it has less than 5 years to go, and the next day, Merrill Lynch came out and said it's more like 4 years rather than five. Well, you can quibble if you like. See, your problem is that your dollar has shrunk 13.7% per year for the last 7 years. Let's take a look at a basket of currencies, but to keep it simple, I'll just use the euro. And if you take the dollar, use the euro as a proxy for a basket of currencies, you'll discover that the value of the dollar against the euro has declined by 13.7% per year. Let me put those in other terms. If you could buy your oil, your gas for your car with $2,001, it would cost you $60 a barrel, not $130. It isn't the fuel that's being manipulated, it's your dollar, the Federal Reserve. That's the program. Because we have so much debt, we have to repay them with cheaper dollars. So it's been an organized program. And so we've been down 80% over the last 37 years. And that's led, of course, among other things, to an implosion of your stock values and your real estate values. And just to take one, I could drown you with exhibits of popular stocks. Let's just take General Motors as an example. It's down 75% in a year. On it goes. So we notice that we feel it in all kinds of ways. The decline of the U.S. economy, the decline of employment, education, and standards of living. All are in the tank. Praise God for the homeschoolers, because they're beating all the records. Our public educational system, there's only one form of schooling that's biblical, that's homeschooling. And my hats off to those that will take on that commitment. And of course, in today's society, there are incredible aids to facilitate that commitment. But also our standards of living. We're probably the first generation in our history for which our children have a tougher time than we did. And so we have high inflation, declining incomes, and unsustainable debts. See, even in the Depression, when the incomes were down, the prices were also down. We're caught just with the opposite here. And we have unsustainable debts, individually and nationally. What are the things you notice? Well, you notice retail stores are beginning to close. CompUSA has gone bankrupt. Pacific Sunwear, Sharper Image, these are all have shut down, closed their stores, they're bankrupt. Bennigan's Restaurant, Glenn and the Things, Levitt's Furniture, after 98 years is going out of business. You see a trend here? On it goes. And on it goes. Foot Locker, what have you. Wilson's Leather, Charm Shops, Sprint XL, Ann Taylor, Zales Jewelry. These familiar names to most of us. Disney stores, Gap, Pep Boys, Eddie Bauer. These are store closings. Starbucks closing 600 of theirs. And then even Australia, 61 of 34 there. Dell Computer closing the retail kiosks. And on it goes. Office Max, Home Depot, Macy's. Closing stores. And then also cutting back, I don't have the numbers, didn't get to pull them together for the conference here. J.D. Penney's, J.C. should he say, J.C. Penney, sorry, typo. Lowe's, Office Depot, Rite Aid, and so on. 7,000 so far and continuing. You sense something's wrong here? We have an impending monetary crisis, to say the least. You see, our trade balance is the problem. We buy more than we sell. We always have. We finance our purchases with debt. If you're buying more than you're selling, you've got to borrow to make the difference. Our current imbalances as a country is about $900 billion per year, but let me show you that graphically. In the 1990s, we've always been negative, but in the 1990s, it was less than $100 billion. It got to be about $100 billion in the mid-90s, and we sort of found ways to rationalize that somehow the future would allow us to just absorb that kind of debt load. Well, after the mid-90s, we noticed it increased to about four times that. We're talking about a rate of digging, not the depth of the hole, the rate of digging the hole. And it got to be almost $400 billion per year, and we got a little uncomfortable. Fortunately, in 2001, it showed a little bit of an uptick. And we felt a lot better about that for a while. It's off the chart. That's the first law of holes is to stop digging. Our federal deficit has to, our government also, no, that's us. Let's talk about just our government. That was our total economy. Let's talk about our government. It also spends more than it takes in on a cash basis. And they fund the difference with government debt. The Treasury then has to borrow $250 billion a year for the federal government and $900 billion a year for our trade deficit. So they have to somehow come up with over $1 billion per year. I'm sorry, a trillion. See, I meant a trillion. I moved my decimal point. You know, a billion here and a billion there, you're talking real money, you know. Now, it's $3 billion a day the Treasury has to find and has to borrow that from foreign institutions. And let me tell you a secret. Those foreign institutions are not stupid. They're lending to the most indebted nation on the planet Earth by a factor of 10. We're nine times larger than the next runner-up to that contest. Now, the chairman of the Federal Reserve is the most powerful non-elected person in the world, some people feel. But you need to understand that our current administration has borrowed more money than all 42 administrations in the history of this country put together. That may sound, you know, wild, but it's true. So and so we have to pay back those debts with cheaper dollars. During the 18 years that Greenspan was head of the Federal Reserve, the value of the dollar was cut in half in those 18 years. Bernanke is now in charge, and the rate is increasing. And the basic measure of liquidity, the report card, if you will, of the Federal Reserve is a thing called the M3. There are four liquidity measures, M0, 1, 2, and 3. And if you've taken economics in college, you know the M3 is your primary indicator of liquidity, and that's what the Federal Reserve is mandated to manage. Well, effectively, we learn, since March of 2006, the Federal Reserve is saving money by deciding not to print the report card. Can you imagine General Motors coming to its shareholders and saying, by the way, we're not going to publish an annual report anymore? Imagine how that would go over. Well, that's what the Federal Reserve did in March of 2006. Let's just talk about entitlement costs. These are costs that your Congress at this point has no control over. It's in the system. And if you look at those entitlement costs, Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, they currently represent about 8.4% of the entire domestic product of this country. But it's going to get bigger, and it doesn't take any mathematical whiz to realize that that is unsustainable, and no one is doing anything about it. Every congressman, every senator deserves to be fired. It's not just them. Let's look at the consumer. Real estate debt is now approximates the federal debt. Everybody is on a borrowing binge, has been for decades. We've spent a long time digging the hole that we're now in. Should we be surprised that foreclosures are escalating? Hardly. In fact, we notice the recent news is that Freddie Mac and Freddie Mae, both of them, are down to zero, virtually, and there's a bailout program to try to keep them alive, to keep the whole system afloat for a little bit longer. But that, all the numbers you've seen, is just the tip of the iceberg. What is really scary is the leverage that you don't see, that doesn't show up in any of the ratios. And that's a thing called derivatives. They're hidden behind the scenes. What is a derivative? That's an investment that derives its value from some other investment. It derives its value from something else. And these things start to chain each other, and they chain so in such a complex fashion that the professionals in the field today admit they can't unravel what they're worth. Boy, that's scary. These include options, warrants, futures, convertibles. They all have useful purposes, but those purposes have been abused through the greed of Wall Street and other things. And these, the widespread emergence of derivatives have multiplied the risks on the entire global market. This is not unique to our country. The U.S. derivative market is 8 times larger than our entire national economy, a gross domestic product of the country, by a factor of 8. That's kind of exciting. In 1995, commercial banks had about $17 trillion in derivatives. That's a big number. But by 2004, it was $75 trillion, several 100% increase in those 10 years. And it's continuing about 20 or 30% per year, derivatives. 90% are traded over the counter with no form of regulation, no way to regulate these things. The total market estimate is something in the neighborhood of $400 trillion, but no one's quite sure. Now, the banks, of course, are leveraged because they trade in these heavily. $40 trillion, 4 times the U.S. GDP, which is about $11 trillion. 2005, it gets to that 39, goes up to $76 trillion in derivatives. And out of that $76.5 trillion in derivatives, there is only $715 billion in equity. If you can visualize a giant pyramid upside down, there, the little pin it's sitting on is less than 1% of the total value. About 0.9% is covered by equity. That's from the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and it is just an educated guess. 7 banks, the major banks, hold 96% of all the derivative holdings. If you're in one of those banks, you ought to be nervous. J.P. Morgan, Chase, Bank of America, Citibank hold together about $29 trillion. They alone account for three times an amount equal to three times the total economy of the United States. So is any surprise that banking is also going in the tank? And there's questions of survival. The gap between future U.S. receipts and future U.S. government obligations now totals $65 trillion, $66 trillion really. That's impossible for the U.S. to reconcile, which means, in effect, in the opinion of the Federal Reserve, among others, the U.S. is now technically bankrupt because their assets are less than their liabilities and getting worse. Foreign investors now hold a record of 80% of the T-notes, treasury bills, and they're all due between 3 and 10 years. We're all facing an election. Let me tell you, you could put Clark Kent in the White House, and it wouldn't make much difference. Whoever steps in the Oval Office after this election will step into quicksand because of the incredible, virtually insoluble problems facing him. Not since the 19th century have foreigners owned so much of the American debt. International investors now own $672 billion of the $800 billion treasuries due in 3 to 10 years. These are the short-term ones. One of the fears here is inflation, of course. But there's a point at which inflation feeds on itself. And that's, you think a depression is scary, that's really scary. In Germany, 1920, food prices doubled every 49 hours. My grandparents had a restaurant. They sold the restaurant to retire. When the escrow opened, it was enough to retire on. When the escrow closed, what they got was enough to buy a loaf of bread. And a loaf of bread in 1920 cost 1 mark. In 1923, 750 million marks. That's kind of exciting. In Russia in 1990, same thing. 1994 to 1999, in 5 years. Went from 100 rubles to the dollar to 30,000 rubles to the dollar. And it's not unique to Germany back in the 20s. It's happened many times on the planet Earth in various years, and it always results in a regime change. The United States is now the largest debtor in the entire world by a factor of 10 to 1. And that it now has in debt instruments 48 oodles. Some people are saying it's the end of money. The money supply from 1620, Mayflower Compact, what have you, till 1974, in 354 years, there was enough, $1 trillion in currency was enough to manage our affairs. From 1974 to 2006, in 10 months, we had to add an additional trillion. And it gets worse and worse, obviously. They're now printing. Now they've discovered they don't have to print the dollars. They can make electronic transfers. And they're busily doing that. So, household debt, that's you and me, gang. Double the past 6 years. So on. So the whole concept of hyperinflation is probably one of our biggest fears. Well, let's change the subject. We started talking about gas and fuel in the gas tank. There's some interesting news on the energy horizon that I thought we can't possibly exhaust this in the few moments of we have together, but we can talk a little bit. Oil supplies are limited, right? Back in 1956, a geologist by the name of M. King Hubert predicted that the U.S. oil production would peak in the early 70s. And the people in the petroleum industry laughed him to scorn. What does he know? His projections were highly controversial, but he turned out to be right. The methodology he was using was very revealing. So they took his methodology and didn't apply it to the U.S. Remember, U.S. was an oil exporter back in the 50s. They applied it to the world. And the peak oil for the world was predicted to be between 2004 and 2008, we'd peak out. Yes, there'll be new discoveries, but not at the rate that the old discoveries were depleting. So we're at a peak, apparently. Maybe. This is from Nature, Science, Scientific American. These are reputable journals. This isn't some, you know, buddy's newsletter. This is, you know, serious publications. And so his projections Whether you take a 1.8 trillion or 2.1 trillion, there's some technicalities involved. In any case, the peak occurs in the early teens of 2000. 2008 is a pretty good estimate. But let's talk about another subject you don't hear too much about, and that's synthetic fuels. Much of the synthetic fuels that we run into are con jobs. I'm not going to get into the whole corn nonsense. We found a way to make most of the world go hungry by... I won't start on that. But back in the German history, a couple of guys, Frederick Burgess in the Rheinau, Meinheim, developed the first petroleum from coal, which led to the German high-pressure coal hydrogenation patents and processes in 1910 to 1925. In 1923, Franz Fischer and Hans Krupps developed an improved process to produce liquid fuels from coal, often called the FT process or the Fischer-Krupps process. Turns out to be very, very important. It was critical, of course, for the Nazis to somehow survive their problems. By the time you get to the 30s, IG Farben had industrialized 12 coal hydrogenation factories, and then during the war, he added 9 more. They lived on synthetic fuels. Now, these two processes produce two different derivative products. Hydrogenation can produce high-grade aviation and motor fuels, and the FT process, Fischer-Krupps process, diesel fuel lubricants and low-grade gasoline normally. Well, a couple of other facts you want to put in perspective here. Canada's production of synthetic fuel will shortly exceed its conventional oil production. In fact, Alberta, you may not realize, Alberta has the largest known oil reserve in the world. This exceeds the entire Middle East all put together. That's kind of exciting. Now, the 4/5 of the worldwide deposits of heavy hydrocarbons are in the Western Hemisphere. So there's no excuse for us to have a policy of dependency, especially on those people that hate us. That's one of two things. That's either stupid or worse. It may be a long-term attempt to nationalize our oil industry. That's what happened in Canada. That's what happened in Algeria and so forth. Well, when you start talking about coal-to-liquid processes, the leader in that today is China. Beijing sets the standard for adapting the Fischer-Krupps method into an industrial method for coal-to-liquid, which is a cliché in process here. In partnership with Royal Dutch Shell, an oxygenated gasification technology permits isolating carbon dioxide during the process, which is not only improves the process, produces some other benefits. So that's a big deal, big breakthrough. That was a speculation that Royal Dutch and Canada and China took together, and it's been a big win for them. There are now 30 large-scale CTL projects, and that gets feasible once oil gets above $30 to $40 a barrel. That changes. There are all kinds of processes that are otherwise not economic that now become useful, and that's where we are, obviously. And so these all take advantage of China's extensive coal reserves. They have huge coal reserves. By the way, this is a little dangerous because those they have about 5,000 deaths a year coal mining, about 100 a week. It's a very, very risky proposition, but that's the cost of coal in China. China has enough coal reserves to meet all their needs for the next several centuries, several hundred years. And they're establishing storage facilities beyond their own consumption requirements in Chongqing. Now, what's interesting here, they are buying, they're building huge storage tanks. In fact, they purchased half of all the concrete on the planet Earth last year. There are projects in the U.S. that are behind schedule because you can't get concrete. Why? Because China's been collecting it all. Because why? They're building, and we'll talk about that tonight, they're building the equivalent of a city, equivalent to the size of Philadelphia, every 2 months. And they have 174 cities now that are over a million occupants. It's an interesting story in its own right. The main point is, though, they realize it's better to put their, they improved their cash position by 40% in the last 3 months. And they're putting their cash into oil. Huge storage tanks. Why put it in depreciating dollars? Why put it in something they know they're going to need? That makes sense. So let's talk a little bit about energy. There is a bright spot on the horizon that you don't hear about very much. How many know that gasoline is a fossil fuel? How many have been told that? How many believe that? It turns out most petroleum engineers do believe that. But it turns out it's possible that we're all wrong. Is fossil fuels one of these myths from the past? There are three theories of origins since about the 19th century. One theory of origin is that it's primordial, that it dates back to the Earth's origin or Noah's flood or whatever. And that approach has some merit. The more common view among scientists and geologists is that oil is produced from the decay of living organisms, and the current thinking is they're very, very small organisms, not dinosaurs or tree leaves, they're ocean plankton. But in any case, these proliferated millions of years ago during relatively brief periods of global warming, of course, and were buried under ocean sediment under fortuitous circumstances. That's a view that's widely held among most knowledgeable geologists today. But there are a growing number that are beginning to suspect or believe that oil is produced by an inorganic process. Very, very controversial. See, while the organic theorists have long posited that the material required to produce hydrocarbons in sedimentary rock came from dinosaurs and ancient forests or what have you, more recent arguments advance the theory that the organisms had to be small, like plankton. That may have been the real origin. Okay. What about abiotic oil, oil that's not biological? During the last half of the 20th century, with the advances in geophysics and geochemistry, most scientists have lined up on the biotic theory, the one that we've all been told. But in the 1950s, a small group of Russian and Ukrainian geologists, and including a small handful of Western scientists, among them was a Cornell University physicist by the name of Thomas Gold. He passed away, but he's known for a book that he wrote on this area. The Russians are upset because they feel he plagiarized their work. But without quarreling who really started this, the point is they all held a view that oil may be abiotic, that is not biological. Thomas Gold wrote a book called The Deep Hot Biosphere in 1998. And argued that hydrocarbons existed at the time of the formation of the solar system. And they're known to be abundant on other planets, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and some of the moons of those planets, where no life is presumed to have flourished in the past. So the oil that's there can't have come from biology. It must have come some other way, is the argument. So we have the abiotic theory. Some people call it the abiogenic theory, same equivalent term. It holds that hydrocarbons are naturally produced on a continual basis throughout the solar system, including the mantle of the Earth. Let me translate that in political terms. That means it's renewable energy. It's renewable energy, if they're correct. The advocates of this view believe that oil seeps up through the bedrock cracks and deposits itself in sedimentary rock, and that's where you find it when you drill. And that was natural to presume that's what was formed, not necessarily so. Traditional petrogeologists apparently confuse the sedimentary rock as the originator rather than just simply being a depository. The organic materials that are found in petroleum deposits are easily explained by the metabolism of bacteria which have been found in extreme environments similar to the Earth's mantle. These peculiar bacteria, called hyperthermophiles, in other words, bacteria that can thrive in extreme environments, have been found in hypothermal vents at the bottom of volcanoes and places where scientists believed life was impossible. These conditions where life would be impossible, they discover there is a kind of bacteria that apparently thrives there. The abiotic origin of petroleum deposits would explain some phenomena that are not currently understood. For example, why petroleum deposits almost always contain biologically inert helium. They can't explain why it would. Now you have to understand there's two kinds of carbon. There's carbon 12, which is the biological one, there's carbon 13, which is not. The abiotic origin theory has been rejected by most biologists because of the low content of carbon 13 isotopes. Hydrogen-rich fluids have now been reported venting at the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean, produced by abiotic synthesis of hydrocarbons in the mantle of the Earth. And this has been, Gioria Proskorowski, School of Oceanography, University of Washington, Seattle, has reported this in Science. And this was an alert into our database by a guy that you need to know anyway, a guy by the name of Jerry Corsi, who is a gold medallion holder, by the way. But he wrote a book some years ago for the Swift Boat guys that ended John Kerry's bid. He then wrote a book called Atomic Iran that woke people up to the threat of Ahmadinejad. Then he wrote a book called The Late Great USA, which brought a screeching halt to Bush's attempt to merge Mexico, Canada, and the United States. Let's hope it's dead. The highways are still being built and all that, but I won't go into that here. His most recent book is a must-read for anyone that takes America seriously. It's called Obama Nation. Jerry is a PhD from Harvard, an old friend from the Council on National Policy, and he is a thorough researcher with a commitment of diligent documentation. So I encourage you to be aware of him. But in any case, he's the one that put us on to this new evidence for abiotic hydrocarbons. There is a place in the Mid-Atlantic Range, they call it the Lost City because it has some peculiar ridges in it. That's just the name of the place. It's about 2,100 feet below sea level. And it's noted, it gets its name from these some very strange 90 to 200 foot towers, mineral towers that are in there. But the point is, this is the second time that Proskorowski and his team descended in a scientific submarine to collect liquid bubbling up from those sea vents. The first was in about 5 years ago. He found hydrocarbons containing carbon 13 isotopes that appear to be formed from the mantle of the Earth rather than from biological material settled on the ocean floor. The significance of this, the amount isn't significant. It'll be disparaged by the adversaries. But the significance scientifically is extremely profound because that means that oil is a renewable resource. Changes some perspectives, doesn't it? The Fischer-Tropsch reaction, see, in carbon-13 is a carbon isotope they associate with abiotic origin compared to carbon-12, which is typically associated with biological origin, a difference in atomic weight. Extra neutron in there. Proskorowski attributes the hydrothermal fluids to abiotic production by the Fischer-Tropsch reactions. And they were the first developed by the German scientists that I mentioned that was where they produced synthetic fuel from coal. Same kind of a process is involved here. So his conclusion of his article for Science magazine says, our findings illustrate that the abiotic synthesis of hydrocarbons in nature may occur in the presence of ultramafic rocks, water, and moderate amounts of heat. Now, what are those kinds of rocks? They're rocks with high ferromagnetism content used to describe dark igneous rock that over 90% of whose content consists of ferromagnesian materials, including a bunch of other things I can't pronounce properly. Okay. All right. Now, so this is new evidence. This is the second discovery in recent years adding weight to the abiotic theory of origin of oil. Let me add one more. In 2005, NASA sent a probe to Titan, which is the giant moon of Saturn, discovered abundant carbon-13 methane that NASA declared to be abiotic origin. In other words, on that moon, Saturn, they found hydrocarbons. So the one thing that's pretty obvious, they're not biological in their origin. They're inorganic in their origin. That changes our whole perspective. Yes, we need to understand better what goes on in the mantle of the Earth, but apparently the production of oil is a byproduct of what's going on there. That changes perspective. So as we try to get a perspective of this, let's realize that over half of the known reserves are in the Western Hemisphere in the first place, and abundantly in Alberta and related regions. There's no reason for us to be held hostage to the legacy of hate that characterized the Middle East. So, okay, here we are. We always got to get to, I love what John Leffler calls the so what question. You know, so what do we do about it? What can we do about that? So what's the so what question? Well, that leads to what we call the vortex strategy. You and I cannot change the price of oil. We can't probably individually change the election, although I hope all of us will have some kind of an impact on that. I hope we'll all pray very hard and do our homework and do what the Spirit leads us to do. I personally am looking at the election as a litmus test. I don't know whether God's judgment on America has already started or if we have a reprieve for a while. I'll tell you the day after the election. I'm not being flip here. I'm being quite serious. Because I have always preached 2 Chronicles 7:14, where God says, if my people who are called by my name will do four things, I'll do three. If they will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then will I hear from heaven, forgive their sin, and heal their land. I've always argued that the problem in America is not the pagan left. The problem in America is not the executives in Hollywood or the people that are in the quarters that, you know, in the quarters of power. The problem in America is in the body of Christ. It's our sin that's in the way of God doing what he'd prefer to do. Because I believe he'd prefer America to continue to be a beachhead for the gospel to a hurting world. And what's in the way is us. So I'll leave you with that. Is it too late? I don't know. There's times this past year I lost my optimism. I remember Dr. Keller told me once, Chuck, you have to understand what an optimist is and what a pessimist is. A pessimist is the guy with more information. He said, the optimist is a guy who thinks the future's uncertain. We all winced. Said dinner table. Says, Chuck, we have a duty to be an optimist because then we at least try. That was his remedy. But I have to tell you, I got very pessimistic. In the last few weeks, there's a breath of fresh air on my horizon. Mm-hmm. Can they solve our problems? I don't know. But the choice, I applaud the clarity. Because it's the difference between night and day. I often say it's definitely black and white, but people think I'm making a racial slur. I'm not. That's not the issue. That's not the issue. Prudent man foreseeth evil and hideth himself. The simple pass on are punished. And that's what the vortex is. See, our times are uncertain. We don't know if it's going to be inflation or deflation. We don't know if there's going to be a nuclear event over Iran or North Korea or whatever. We can go on and make a whole list of uncertainties. It's impossible to predict. Is it going to be hyperinflation or depression? Or are there going to be logistics? Can you get enough food to feed your family? Those are serious questions in America these days. What's the optimum strategy under conditions of uncertainty? Mobility. If it's a certain terrain, you want mobility. In financial terms, that means liquidity. You want to get liquid. You don't invest for earnings. You protect capital. Plenty of bargains later. So we have a four-step program. Most of you are familiar with it. Lower your cost of living, get out of debt, guard your liquidity, and then the most important factor of all. Lower your cost of living. Don't count on increases of income. You have an income, and then you have expenses, which are probably larger than your income. Your first step has to be to lower your expenses below your income so that you have something of your own to keep. Painfully simple, not easy to do, and your most important adjustment is not with dollars, it's with your time. Where are you spending your time? Get out of debt is the next step. Debt is a presumption on the future. It's contrary to God's plan for your life. You need to get out of debt. The borrower is slave to the lender. Believe it. Nationally and personally. Use the increments from step one to repair your situation refinance those variable mortgages, eliminate your credit card debt, and establish and control your budget as if your life depended on it, because it does. That's the net of it. Then, once you do that, guard such liquidity as you have. Once debt is under control, you use your margin from step one to establish reserves. And then what you want to do is diversify that among different asset classifications. Solomon says seven or eight things. Maintain liquidity. Don't maximize earnings. Stay flexible. Straddle industries, straddle borders, straddle currencies. Don't be stuck in any one of those. Another step you want to take is get your assets out of reach from your adversaries. It is a warfare. First of all, find out who your adversaries are. Anybody with a law degree. And I'm not joking. Take precautionary steps before they're needed. What do I mean by that? Asset protection. We live in a litigious society. There's going to be underemployed attorneys looking through the tax rolls of property, trying to find one they can contrive a grievance against and put it into court, which is a roulette wheel. Anyone can sue anyone. Someone does every 10 seconds. We live in a litigious society. How do you protect yourself from what's called in the trade the unworthy judgment? A guy shows up at your door, rings your doorbell, has a court judgment for $10 million against you. What are you going to do about it? Take off your wristwatch, say, that's all I own, go away. Own nothing. See, every lawsuit's a roulette wheel, and you're playing the roulette wheel in their game. Protect yourself in advance against what's called the unworthy judgment. I'm assuming you've got means to protect here. And the ultimate defense, of course, is to own nothing. What you don't own, they can't steal from you. There's no reason to own your laptop, or your car, or your house even. Trusts, corporations, and foundations are some of the means of protection here. They originate in English common law. They're testamentary trusts and inter vivos living trusts, that is revocable and irrevocable, they're all kinds. Trusts have advantages. They speed up the distribution of assets rather than probate. They're more difficult to contest, and they're more private than a will. They can be revocable, so you can change them anytime you like. Some of the most useful ones in certain situations are irrevocable. They're very powerful for certain purposes. You want to check into these things. And, of course, they avoid the time and expense and uncertainties of probate. And the disadvantage of trusts, they cost between $500 and $2,000, depending on how complicated they are. They require administration and maintenance. They subject you to possible mismanagement for the successor trustee, those kinds of issues. And the tax and creditor considerations may favor an irrevocable trust. You need to have an advisor to talk you through that. And all kinds of the trustors, that is the creators of the trust, and the managers can be the same person. There are issues of successor trustees you got to deal with and want to designate the beneficiaries and all that. You transfer them out of your name as individual into your name as a trustee. Then they can't take it away from you. They have to be very carefully drafted, and they need to be done a year before you need them, or they're considered a strategy to defraud creditors. There are charitable remainder trusts. You can donate it to your charity and still use it for the rest of your life if you want to. There are all kinds of tax benefits and other benefits, then they can't steal it from you there too. And there's all kinds of, these strategies can all be managed as a mixed strategy. But I encourage you to think about, if you have significant means, internationalize, explore offshore trusts. There are a number of jurisdictions that specialize in that. They're private, they're sound, they are expensive. There are international bank accounts that will surprise you how powerful they are. There are issues of disclosure, there are issues of accessibility. There's foreign life insurance, which is invisible because it's not a bank account, it's a contract. So you can do that very invisibly should you choose to. The secret to that is either in the UK or in Switzerland. Passports. Have a current passport. If you have a family, make sure you have an independent passport for each member of the family. These are all things that are easy to do, but when you need them, you got to have them. So the main point is have a plan. Do you have a plan? Do your own homework. Do your reading and all that. Use an attorney that's experienced in this field, that is asset protection. Be diligent because it will require continuous maintenance. But the most important thing of all is your spiritual portfolio, your personal armory. Do a serious study of Ephesians 6 and put it to practice. Realize that you need to establish a family priesthood. Guys, that's your job. If you're not in a small study group during the week, shame on you. You can't grow in the Word of God with a 45-minute message once a week. You want to be in a small group, small enough so people can ask questions without embarrassment, where you share the Word of God verse by verse, wherever. You want to be self-sufficient. You want to have health surveillance and maintenance. You want to, and there's discoveries for homeschooling for those of you there. And I don't think I made it on time this time. I did break the tradition by being on time once, but I think Bill's given up on me as far as that's concerned, right?
This has been Earth, Energy, and Economics, presented by Chuck Missler. To receive a free catalog of over 200 awesome Stealing the Mind Bible studies on DVDs, CDs, or audio tape, information on upcoming Bible conferences in your area, or details of our missionary outreach and trips to Israel, call Compass at 1-800-977-2177 24 hours a day, or on the web at compass.org.